Bhagavan, Good evening, good afternoon, welcome. I hope that most of you were here to hear Mahalia Jackson singing He's Got the Whole World in His Hands, which, as I was contemplating what songs to play for the Divine Masculine, I was looking through my iTunes song sheet looking for something about Shiva or Krishna, and I saw this fantastic gospel song by Mahalia Jackson. And I realized that really when we contemplate the Divine Masculine, when we bring our awareness to, let's say, the sweetest, most protective, most loving, most soothing image of the Divine Masculine in whom we can take refuge, what I believe we see, what I believe we imagine, is this being who has the whole world at his hands, who contains the universe inside his divine body. That is, when we think about the Divine Masculine, when we contemplate the Divine Masculine, what we are actually doing is contemplating that profound collective image of God, the universal Divine Masculine, whom in the English language we call God. And I'm going to call the Divine Masculine God for now, even though I know that this term has all sorts of associations that really have not that much to do with what we're going to be practicing during this time. So, but nonetheless, whether we think of the Divine Masculine as an inner archetype or as the omnipotent Father of the universe, whenever we contemplate the Sacred Masculine, we come to terms with that archetypal God image that all of us carry inside us. Some of it is collective, some of it is personal. So in approaching the masculine divine, we get to look at our images of the masculine in many ways that are productive and some ways that are left over from the most archaic levels of our being. So who are we opening up to? God the Father, God the Almighty, God the Omnipotent, God the Absolute, God the Protector, God the Giver of Ethics, Law, and Justice, God the Son, God the Holy Lover, God the Yogi, God the Guru, the Teacher, and, of course, God the Self, the Divine Masculine as that pole of our consciousness, which holds us like a pillar of absolute steadiness. And as you know, if you're familiar with the yogic tradition and with the Indian tradition, one of the primal images of God, the masculine, of the divine sacred masculine, is the pillar, the lingam, which is, of course, a form of the phallus, of the primal masculine thrusting, active, dynamic quality of consciousness, and yet which at the same time stands for stability, stands for stillness, because the Divine Masculine embodies, at least in the Indian yogic tradition, which we'll be working with in these three-week classes, the Divine Masculine embodies stability, primal stability, just as the Divine Feminine in the yogic tradition embodies dynamism and playfulness. So I'm very excited to begin this class, and I begin it with love and some trepidation. I, like all of you, carry multiple images of the divine, from the one I remember from my childhood, which is God, the big daddy in the sky with a long white beard, whom I conceived as living in the clouds and having no feet. That question always bothered me as a child. Does God have feet? Because my primal image of the divine was one that came out of, you know, I guess the images of God in Christian and Jewish storybooks, the old man with the white beard. God in the Indian tradition is not like that at all, although there are images of the divine masculine that are definitely grandfathers. But what I'd like to say is that when we tune into these deity images, we're tuning into powerfully psychoactive doorways into our own divine self. In other words, for thousands of years, the divine masculine has been our default setting for ultimate reality. God is masculine in virtually every religious tradition. India is an exception, especially in the comparatively modern tantric traditions, because unlike in the West, at least in Tantra, the divine is understood to be equally masculine and feminine. Every masculine divinity has a feminine consort, and in the deep tradition of yoga, the masculine divine is considered to be primal consciousness, primal awareness, while the feminine divine is considered to be the power, the dynamism, the activity of the masculine divine. So this is a way of looking at the divine masculine that may be new to some of us. And at the same time, in the East as well as in the West, most people grow up with an image of the divine, an image of God as the Lord, as He, the divine He. Nowadays, of course, we're learning how to neutralize the pronouns to say God or Goddess. You know, we're kind of politically correct in our religious talk as we are in other aspects of our life. Or we might use the wonderfully neutral term of Eastern philosophy, which is to say we call the ultimate reality that or it, indicating its essential formless impersonality. But that said, most of us are conditioned to relate to the divine as masculine. And for Westerners, for Jews and Christians, or ex-Jews and Christians, or people like myself who were brought up more or less agnostic, my parents were refugees from traditional religion, although they definitely had their own deep spirituality. But our God images in the West tend to be based on the God of what Joseph Campbell called the Fertile Crescent religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. So the Father God of the Judeo-Christian cultures is primarily a parent, even a master, hopefully a benign one, but for many of us, because this is encoded very deeply in our consciousness, often a judgmental, punishing, limiting deity who is the instrument behind secular authority, not to speak of religious authority. In fact, to confuse matters, as contemporary psychologists often point out, our inner image of the divine has a lot to do with the way our primary caretakers were with us. So, for example, if our parents, especially our father, we're loving and permissive, we'll tend to see God as an all-loving deity who doesn't demand too much of us, who forgives us. If our parents were perfectionistic and withholding, we'll tend to believe that God demands good behavior from us, that we're not favored, we're not blessed unless we're good. And how many of us hold that idea? How many of us actually become rebels because we get so angry at the idea that God only loves us if we're good. And of course, if our parents were angry or got angry at critical moments, then our God image will tend to be angry. And if you remember that line, and I believe it's in Revelations, the biblical book Revelations, about how terrible it is to fall into the hands of the angry God. So for many of us, I'm just going to go on about this a little bit. Our mythic God image tends to be a little scary. That God sends floods, wipes out cities for being sinful, sends plagues on the Egyptians when he wants to free his chosen people, tells Abraham to sacrifice his son, even though he kind of changes his mind at the last minute and tells Abraham that it was only a test. But how many of us, in our most primitive childlike responses to the divine in the Western tradition, think of the idea of spiritual tests as being a requirement that we be willing to sacrifice our most cherished love or ourselves for the sake of being in a good relationship with God. So this fear-based idea about the masculine divine is in our DNA. And that's one reason why so many of us have trouble with the word God, and it's one reason why in modern times, famously, rational people, many rational people declared with Nietzsche, God is dead. I recently read a piece by a theologian who described meeting my guru, Swami Muktananda, at a critical moment in his life when he was dealing with the fact that he was a theologian and that he was living in a culture which had declared God dead. And he asked a question about this to my guru, and my guru basically said, don't believe in the God of your religion. Don't believe in anything religion says. It's a very radical statement. Religion is like a fence to keep young souls in line. But if you pay too much attention to what religion says to you about God, it'll get in the way of your real experience of what God really is. And of course, I believe that's one reason why so many of us in the West have been drawn to Eastern, especially Buddhist, ideas about spirituality. Perhaps because it's in so much Eastern spirituality as we generally experience it in the West. The goal of spirituality is not a personal divine. In Buddhism, there really is not a God figure, even though many aspects of Buddhism, the Tibetans especially, have a lot of beings whom I would call deities. And the same is true in non-dual Vedanta, which is a Hindu tradition that has a lot in common with Buddhism, in which the core of reality is understood to be pure no-thingness, an emptiness that's capable of infinite transmutation within itself, but essentially formless, without any attributes at all, a vast empty suchness. This is the masculine divine in what I guess we could call the highest forms of Eastern religion, as well as in the highest forms of Western mysticism. Formless, without any attributes, a vast empty suchness, an awareing that cannot be objectified because it is pure subjectivity. And yet out of that emptiness come zillions of forms. So In these traditions, in, for example, Buddhism and non-dual Vedanta, you don't really need to get involved with any kind of personal deity, either a masculine or a feminine deity, because what you're trying to do is simply to peel away whatever ideas or concepts you might have about yourself so that you can know yourself as this pure subject, this I without an object, which can eventually expand to show you that your I is actually the I that holds the all. My guru, who was a lifelong Shaivite, that is, a devotee of the divine in the form of Shiva, in other words, he was a lover of a personal deity, but he used to say, Shiva is not a Hindu deity. Shiva is pure boundless consciousness. Shiva is the eternal subject. Shiva is the pure I awareness. Shiva is boundless love. So he saw the entire world as God, and all of us is filled with God. He saw the masculine divine as being not gender-related at all, but pure formless consciousness. And yet, he was also a Hindu, and he had the beautiful, enlightened Hindu's brilliantly sophisticated understanding of the interplay between the form and the formless, the understanding of how human consciousness is both created out of divine consciousness and also creates the image of the divine in a form that it can understand and relate to. So even though my guru was completely living in the experience of the divine as non-dual presence within everything, within his own heart, he was also totally comfortable with the idea that non-dual presence could transmute into an utterly, absolutely mythic deity form, like Shiva or Krishna or some aspect of the Divine Mother. So, for example, he literally worshipped the Divine Feminine as Kundalini Shakti, the energy of transformation within his own body. And yet he could also speak of her as Lakshmi and make jokes about how we have to worship Lakshmi so that she'll be good to us and give us the wherewithal, the money, to live in the world. And when he was asked by a reporter, almost just about 2 weeks before he left his body in 1982, he was asked by a reporter what he saw as his highest accomplishment, the thing he was most proud of in his life. He didn't say, I'm most proud that I've done years of spiritual practice and realized the truth. He didn't say, I'm proud that I awakened thousands of people. He said, the thing I'm most proud of is that I've become friends with Shiva. The thing that I'm most proud of is that I've become friends with Shiva. So our life as spiritual beings, if we want it to be truly in line with the nature of this infinitely mysterious universe, has room for the paradox that the absolute reality has no form, no attributes, is omnipresent, is in everything, is transcendent and immanent. And also for the wild and crazy idea that the absolute divinity not only takes forms as human beings and land forms and plants and animals, it also takes form as deities, as infinitely powerful beings who contain within themselves the absolute power, glory, omnipotence of that formless divine suchness. It's an extraordinarily mind-blowing idea. So I want to just give you some of the basics of what we're going to be doing during this class. But before we begin, before we continue, that is, let's just take a few moments and chant, offer our practice, and settle into our first meditation. And I want to say, before we begin our chanting and meditation, that the primary meditation that we're going to be doing in these first two classes is one that those of you who've practiced with me before will be familiar with. It's the practice of meditating inside the central channel of the body with the mantra Soham. Soham is a mantra of the Indian yogic tradition that means I am that or I am he. So it's the mantra for self-identifying with the divine masculine in its absolute form, in its formless form. And we're going to practice with attention to the inner body. So as we prepare to chant, you can find yourself a comfortable posture, sitting upright. Connect your sit bones, your hips and thighs and buttocks to the seat. Really feel the pressure of the base of your posture against the seat, and see if you can allow yourself to take the support of the seat. Inhaling, feel that the breath goes down to the very core of the pelvis, and exhaling, feel that it rises up through the center of the body, allowing your chest to lift and open, your shoulder blades to release down your back. Take a moment or two now just to be aware of the movement of the breath. First, the feeling of the breath flowing in and out of your nostrils, and then the feeling of the breath moving your body, the parts of your body that move with the inhalation and exhalation, whether it's the shoulders or the chest. And now have the feeling, the awareness. For some of you, it's a very palpable experience. For some of you, it may be new. Have the feeling that a slender column of energy flows from the base of the spine, from the coccyx, up through the center of the body, up through the belly, through the solar plexus, through the heart, through the center of the throat, up through the palate, through the center of the head, up to the crown. And see if you can begin to bring your attention and your sense of the movement of the breath to the presence of this inner column of energy, which is known in Sanskrit as the Sushumna Nadi, or the auspicious channel, or the central channel, the Madhya Nadi in Sanskrit. Feel that as the breath flows in, it flows down this central channel. And as the breath flows out, it flows up the channel. And with the inhalation, flows the sound hum. And with the exhalation, the sound soul. So the breath flows in and down towards the base of the spine, down the central channel with hum, up the base of the spine, up the central channel with the sound so. And as you allow the breath to flow in the inner body, letting it gently bring your attention inside, have the sense that you welcome the breath, that the sound of the mantra actually flows with the sound of the breath. That thoughts can come and go. And we'll chant now the mantras that have appeared on your chanting sheets, which I hope you all downloaded, and if not, we'll get to know them. These mantras are a very succinct evocation of the divine in the form of Shiva, whose name means the auspicious presence that underlies all that is. And these mantras address the divine as the teacher, as the guru, who is without form, who is peaceful, who is filled with light, and who is never not supporting us. And we'll chant, as we so often do in these classes, with Krishna Das. We'll chant three times, and then we'll say the words dedicating our practice, spend a few more moments in meditation, and then begin our official conversation. Beings be free of hatred, grasping, and dullness. We ask that we know the equality of all that is. So your awareness now is with the center, the breath flowing in and down towards the base, with the thought hum, flowing up towards the crown, with the thought so. Thoughts may arise, you may be aware of sensations in the body, and your attitude towards all of them is welcoming. Whatever is arising, you welcome it. Whatever is arising, you welcome it. Hum flowing in and down with the inhalation, sa flowing up towards the crown with the exhalation. And your awareness centering more and more in this central channel that connects the base with the crown. Before you open your eyes, first be aware of how your body feels, the sensations in your body, the sounds around you, and consider, when you consider the Divine Masculine, what comes to mind for you? Do you imagine authority? Do you imagine the quality of directionality, focus? Do you think of the Divine Masculine as a disciplinarian, as a protector? As a judge? As a lover? As a savior? How do you see the divine masculine aspects of consciousness? How do you find them in yourself? When you think of the masculine in human form, is there anyone you know who seems to embody the qualities of the divine masculine? What in you do you feel connects you to the sacred masculine? These are some of the questions that we're going to consider this week, and we're also going to enter into our practice of tuning into some of the images of the Divine Masculine as they appear in the yogic tradition, in the Indian tradition, specifically to the images of Shiva, the divine yogi, the outsider, God, the mysterious, inward-focused deity of expanding consciousness, and to Vishnu, whom we'll relate to more specifically in the weeks to come as Krishna. Vishnu, who represents the divine masculine as the guardian of society, the protector of the worlds, who incarnates ethics, dharma, and the quality of complete mastery of the world. So these two images of the divine in Indian spirituality, they're just two of them. And there are many others, of course. I'm going to just mention a few of them because they'll come into our story as we continue. There's, of course, Ganesha, the elephant-headed deity who is the son of Shiva's consort Parvati, who comes into the world created by Parvati herself by a process of parthenogenesis from the skin of her body, and who then is beheaded by his father Shiva as he stands guarding Parvati's bedroom, and then given by Shiva the head of an elephant, and who then becomes Ganesha, a deity whom you evoke for help in overcoming obstacles, for wisdom, and for very, very powerful and secret tantric practices. There's Rama, who's an avatar of Vishnu, who is the incarnation of kingly dharma, skill, prowess in war, and correctness, righteousness in the old classical patriarchal sense of the word. There's Indra, who is the king of the celestial realms, who's a warrior, who's a ruler, and who represents the aspect of the human brain that is able to make rational decisions and sometimes gets carried away. There's Surya, the sun god, whose nature is fiery and warlike, and who literally burns anyone whom he touches, and yet illuminates as no being in the three worlds. So these are just a few of the aspects of the divine masculine in the Indian system, and one of the aspects of the divine masculine that the texts of Indian yoga speak of is Buddha, who in Hinduism is considered to be one of the avatars of Lord Vishnu, the sustaining power of the world. One of the ways that we'll look at these deities is how they function psychoactively to transform our consciousness. The wonderful thing about the God images of the great religions, and this includes the Western religions, of course, is that we can relate to them from whatever level of consciousness we find ourselves at. And we'll find that our understanding about the divine masculine and masculinity in its human form will change as we develop. Joseph Chilton Pierce, in a very wonderful book called The Biology of Transcendence, connects the images of the divine with the triune brain that the brain scientist Paul MacLean wrote about. And he points out that the fear-based images of God are connected to our reptilian brain, that is to the survival-oriented old brain, the most primitive part of the brain that we share with snakes and lizards, and which is, of course, the part of our brain that gets activated when we fear survival, when we fear for our survival. It's where the fight or flight response and our most basic instinctual survival needs are located. And it's in the old brain, the reptilian brain, that our God image is the image of that very primitive, scary Father God who who could arbitrarily destroy our life and whom we have to placate, because the world is a big, scary place. You know, this is where our deep fear of the cosmos manifests as fear of God, fear of the Father, fear of the masculine divine, and of course the feminine divine as well. In our mammalian brain, which is the emotional brain and the midbrain, the limbic system, this is where we connect to emotional love, and it's in this part of the brain that the images of God as a figure of love, as Christ, as Krishna, begin to come in. So if you've ever had the experience of feeling enormously emotionally attached to a divine masculine figure, what is really being activated is this mammalian brain, this emotional brain. And in the emotional brain, when we relate to the divine masculine from the emotional brain, we're also likely to make secret bargains with the divine. This is where we have these unconscious ideas like if I do this, then God will be pleased with me and I'll be rewarded. If I'm good, I will prosper in the world. If I do my yoga, I'll be protected from disease and I'll be successful and people will like me. All of these ways that we relate to the divine as the one whom if we please will protect us from bad things and also improve us, also make our lives better, also ensure our success. And in this place, in this realm of the mammalian brain, where we come to know the God of love, the protective God, we also find ourselves relating to that aspect of God which we hope will make us win, will make us triumph over our enemies, will maybe even though we don't like to admit it, just kind of get rid of our enemies. And then as we come in contact with the newer brain, with the neocortex, our understanding about the divine becomes based on ethics. Our God image becomes much more rational, much more, in fact, often formless. You know, we begin to see the divine as the connective tissue of the world, as that energy which manifests as nature, and we begin to recognize that God is inside us, that the image that we have of the masculine divine is actually kind of a mirror image of our own inner self, a projection of our own inner divinity. So we become sophisticated, we become modern, we begin to understand that what we see on the outside is also a mirror of our inner state, and our image of the divine reflects that. But the truth is that as human beings, we contain all these aspects. We contain all these brains. We understand the divine in all these ways, depending on how stressed we are, depending on how relaxed we are. Our image of the masculine divinity will change, will transform itself. And as men and women, as our understanding about what masculine and feminine in the world transforms, as it has for so many of you in the past 20 or 30 years, which of course may be all the years of your life. I've lived through the transformation of masculine and feminine roles. They're very different now than they were when I was, say, 15. And as our understanding of the masculine expands and our understanding of what it is to be feminine expands, then we also begin to recognize something that is not necessarily so apparent to us at the less developed stages of consciousness, which is simply that masculine and feminine are polarities that exist that exist in all of us, that each of us has a masculine consciousness and a feminine consciousness, and that we actually can benefit profoundly from tuning into the divine masculine as a facet of our consciousness, and also from tuning into the divine feminine as a facet of our consciousness. So there will be moments, there will be times when we can unashamedly, if we're truly open, turn to the divine masculine as literally as a savior, as a protector. If our consciousness of the divine is truly integrated, we'll know that there are actually times in our life when we feel like a child, and that the child in us needs a father, needs a protector. And even if we haven't had a protective father in our worldly life, in our earthly life, nonetheless, we can find that protective father through contemplation, through meditation, and through the myths and stories of the divine masculine. There'll be times in our life when we need the masculine to be a strategist, to be a source of wisdom in worldly life. And again, we can find that image of God as the master strategist both inside us and in mythology. There'll be times when we need to know God as a lover, as the one who loves us unconditionally. And there'll be times when it's tremendously important to deeply recognize the divine masculine as the consciousness of our within our being, as the awareness, that as the witness that remains detached and ever present, whatever is going on in our life. So please be aware now of the inner channel, the channel that runs from the base of the spine up towards the crown. And allow the breath to flow in with the sound hum and flow out with the sound sa. Hum and so, coordinating with the breath. When we talk about the divine masculine through the myths of yoga, there are two qualities that characterize the divine masculine as such. One of them is the quality of freedom. In Sanskrit, the word is swatantriya. The most significant characteristic of the divine masculine is that it is utterly and completely free. In contemporary Neo-Tantra, where we attempt to bring together our ideas of the divine masculine and feminine with our experience as women and men, as human beings with masculine and feminine characteristics, It's often said that the human masculine in its core form is concerned with freedom, wants to be disentangled, is not particularly interested in getting involved in the messiness of family life, and that the divine feminine, on the other hand, is very, very interested in relationships and entanglements and forms and worldly beauty and clothes and houses and all those things. And of course, this is not completely true, because men and women are a beautiful combination of masculine and feminine. Masculinity and femininity are not really gender related in the sense that we're talking about. But if you think of your masculine self, of your masculine consciousness, as embodying freedom, what you might begin to understand, what you might begin to see, is that there is this aspect of yourself, this aspect of your consciousness, which is actually able to stand apart from situations and observe them as a witness. So yes, you're right. We're talking about the divine masculine as the witness consciousness, the one who in every situation of life, in the most emotionally difficult situations, in the most painful situations, in the most physically difficult situations, in the midst of heartbreak, grief, rage, fury, etc., etc., there is this part of the masculine consciousness which is able to stand aside and be the witness, be the observer. This aspect of masculine consciousness is also that aspect of us which in worldly life might pride itself on being objective, which is able to look at situations from different perspectives, understand why so-and-so is angry and somebody else is backing down in front of that anger, understand why different people see the same situation in different ways. This is the great quality of the masculine as utterly free witness. Sometimes that free, objective witness quality will seem to our more feminine aspects as overly detached, as unfeeling. And it's true, the witnessing masculine is able to judge situations without emotion, which is not the same thing as being unfeeling. So this freedom aspect of the divine masculine, this Swatantriya aspect of the divine masculine, is in its highest form completely unconditional. The masculine as freedom is the absolute source of all that is and all that is not. He has no qualities in himself, and therefore he's free to become anything and everything at any moment. His nature is pure awareness and self-cognizing bliss, self-referential bliss. So the divine masculine is awareness in its highest form, is awareness turned into itself, awareness aware of itself. And if you've practiced with one of the non-dual traditions, you'll recognize this state. And in this moment, you might just take the stance of awareness aware of itself and turn your attention backward towards, let's say, the back of the head, and just become aware of that part of yourself that's standing aside from experience, that knows you're listening to me, that knows that there might be some discomfort or sleepiness or happiness or relaxation within you, but who is simply present to that, that pure presence, slightly disembodied, because the masculine consciousness in its purest form is actually free of embodiment. It's beyond the body. It transcends the body. It's through feminine consciousness that we embody. So let yourself be present to your masculine consciousness. And now listen to what the great texts of the tradition that sees God as Vishnu, the sustaining, protecting power of the world, says about the masculine divine. The masculine divine is known in Sanskrit, among other names, as Bhagawan. Bhagawan is usually translated as Lord, but what it really means is the one who is the essence of a Bhaga. Bhaga can be roughly translated as glory. And Bhagawan is one who is possessed, who possesses the six qualities of glory, of divine glory. So what are these? The first one is wisdom, jnana. That is, the masculine divine is all-knowing, but especially all-wise. That is, he knows past, present, and future. He understands the causes of things. He's, in his wisdom, in his knowledge, he recognizes the divine core within everything. He knows himself. So you, in your most purposeful divine masculine, you know yourself. You know who you are. You know your capacities. You know the capacities of others. You have the wisdom, the discernment, the discrimination to know what is helpful and what's harmful. So you have the capacity, the quality of wisdom. And you, as the divine masculine, have the quality of shakti, of strength. So shakti, of course, is the divine feminine, but it also means power, strength. So you have absolute strength. This strength of the divine masculine is its indomitable stability. So nothing can shake the divine. Nothing can shake the masculine, not even the amazing deluding play of the divine feminine when she takes form as Maya. God is unshakable, and this is the sense in which we said earlier, he's the pillar, he's strength itself. And in fact, in the Indian tradition, there are many, many myths of how God takes form as avatars in this world. We'll talk more about that. And one of the ways that you can tell that you're in the presence of an avatar, in case you've ever wondered, is that he's undefeatable. That is to say, God cannot be defeated. His strength is absolute. He's invincible. Another one of God's qualities is fame. I love that. He has cosmic fame. God doesn't just have 15 minutes of fame. God, in whatever form, is the most famous being in all the world, and it's true. You know, it's true, isn't it? I mean, in the West, the Bible is the best-selling book of all time. God's testament in all the different forms it takes, whether it's the Old Testament, the New Testament, the Quran, the Bhagavad Gita, the holy books of all traditions, they are the heart of sacred literature. And whether we call God Shiva, Jehovah, Allah, Vishnu, or the Atman, the self, he's known to all sentient beings. So God, the divine Bhagawan, is incarnate wisdom, incarnate fame, incarnate wealth. So I don't have to say too much about that. This, the divine has everything. He's completely abundant. So, you know, if you do new thought practices, manifestation practices, you know that one of the ways that one of the keys to manifestation practice in the new thought traditions like science of mind or religious science is that you unite your mind with God's mind. You say to yourself, my mind is God's mind. And as God's mind, I possess everything that is. I have complete abundance. So what's the big deal about manifesting $1,500 to pay my rent this month? You know, it's God possesses unlimited wealth. All that is belongs to Bhagawan because, of course, it does. It all comes forth from within him. The fourth quality of Bhagawan, of Bhaga, is beauty. God is the most beautiful. If you've ever had a vision of the divine, any sort of intimation of the divine, the first thing you notice is its beauty. My first divine visions actually took place with my eyes open, and the way it would happen is that I would be walking down the street, and all of a sudden, this very ordinary street would become transfigured. I know many of you have had this experience. One of my friends called it supermarket samadhi. It's like nothing changes, but the world suddenly just sparkles with exquisite beauty. It's radiant. It shines. And if you've ever been around a charismatic teacher, and this is true of, you know, charismatic teachers who aren't even particularly saintly, but who are being transfigured with, you know, a kind of a gift of that you know, what the Christians call charism or gift of, say, the capacity for, you know, for holding an audience spellbound. What you often see when you look at these people is that they shine, they're radiant. They have, for that moment, you know, maybe only for 5 minutes, they have that divine beauty. And, of course, the great saints, Ramana Maharshi or Ramakrishna or Ananda Mahima, have this radiance all the time when you see it, when you look at their pictures. And the sixth quality of the divine masculine is detachment. So we're back to freedom. He's not stuck in any way. Even though he acts in the world through his shakti, his power, he acts with complete renunciation. So nothing is stuck to him. He can't be captured. And this divine quality, this detached quality of the divine masculine, is enormously important to our understanding because, as we said earlier, when we get in touch with our divine masculine consciousness, one of the clear ways that it manifests is as a kind of divine detachment. It's as if we are able to be completely present in life, to live our life, but not to get stuck in it. And this is what the divine masculine does. He manifests as this world through the power of his shakti, his divine feminine quality, but he always remains uninvolved in it, even though he may come again and again to intervene in the world, as these myths tell us. But he never gets stuck. He's always detached. Now, this is a profoundly yogic conception of God. It's not really a Western idea, although Jesus, if you read his teachings, if you read his original teachings very carefully, you see that Jesus, as you know, he's often characterized as a great Western yogi, you know, or Saint Francis. You see in them this capacity for detachment, for renunciation, for just letting everything go, turning back into the divine freedom and the divine love that is present when you just let whatever you might be holding on to slip through your hands. So just for a moment now, see if you can tune into your own divine masculine your own qualities as Bhagawan, as the one who possesses in your inmost consciousness. You have these qualities of wisdom. Find the sense of deep wisdom. This wisdom is, it lives in you. It can be fully manifest in you. At certain moments, you are your wise self. And this is the divine masculine in you. Recognize, and this may be harder, recognize your fame. Somewhere in you, even if you're living a very quiet and obscure life, somewhere in you, you recognize that in your deepest essence, you are fully known to the world. When you tune in to your deep essence, your God self, your divine masculine essence, there is no such thing as obscurity. Your complete uniqueness is absolutely known to that one who lives through us all. Just contemplate how you are known, how you are recognized. Now recognize your own innate power. Even in those times when you feel that in your personhood, in your humanness, you're not experiencing yourself as particularly powerful. Know that your consciousness, your mind, has absolute power. It can create anything. You can, in this moment, through your imagination, fully empower yourself. And if you don't believe it, in this moment, ask that the divine masculine within you reveal to you just a corner of the power and potency that you innately possess. And now become aware of yourself as the possessor of beauty. This body that you live in, this perfectly calibrated divine body in which everything works with everything else. This body is filled with beauty. Your mind and heart are intrinsically, innately beautiful, and perhaps your face is too. See if you can feel the beauty, the radiance of your inner self. And if today you're not feeling beautiful, again, ask Bhagwan, the inner divinity who lives as your essence, your own divine masculine, to show you your beauty. and recognize your own power of abundance. A lot of you have done a lot of work on this one, and you know that if you actually remove the sense of limitation on your abundance, if you give yourself permission to manifest the abundance that you really are, you'll see it, you'll know it. You are abundant. You are an abundant being. You're Bhagawan. And finally, we return to detachment, to freedom, to that in you which is present to experience. To that in you which stands outside the ups and downs of your life, even as you live them. May the Lord be glorified, Bhagawan, the mysterious Shambhu, Shiva, whose only definition is that he is devoid of all definitions. Homage to the wondrous Shambhu, the deluding one, who is yet pure and clear, the hidden one, who has revealed himself in everything. The subtle one, whose form takes the form of the whole universe. May you be glorified, O Deva, who can be worshipped in any manner, in any place, in any form at all. I want to tell you a story, one of the core myths of the Absolute. And it's the story of the sage Markandeya, his encounter with Vishnu, the sustainer of the universe. In the Hindu tradition, as we said, there are many deities, but the two great deities, the ones who are recognized as the polarities of the divine masculine, are Shiva and Vishnu. And Shiva and Vishnu are polar opposites. Vishnu is known as the sustainer. He's the protector of the world. He's the one who holds the world within himself, as we'll see. He's the god of dharma, of righteous action, of ethics, of law. He's the deity who maintains society. Shiva is the outsider. He's the outlaw. As Vishnu lives in beautiful palaces surrounded by nymphs and celestial musicians and sages talking philosophy and singing his praises, Shiva lives in the forests and the mountains. He lives in cremation grounds, and his companions are ghosts and goblins. They're horrific, scary creatures. Shiva is the ultimately detached one. He meditates in solitude for thousands and thousands of years, and he's completely impervious to any form of desire. Vishnu, on the other hand, is the one who satisfies desires. He's the embodiment of fulfilled desire. And yet, as we know, Shiva, although he's an ascetic, a hermit, a yogi, and in fact he's the guru of yogis, he's the progenitor of yoga, Shiva is also the lord of the most powerfully unconventional and erotic relationship in the cosmos. He's the consort of Parvati, Kali, Durga, with whom he makes love for thousands of years at a time. And the two of them are the divine couple of the tantric tradition, whose union symbolizes the union of our vital energy with our pure consciousness. So Vishnu, in his cosmic form, is also known as Narayana. And the tale of Vishnu, the image of Vishnu, and you'll find this image in the private area of the class area of the website, shows him asleep on the cosmic ocean. The cosmic ocean is the boundless ocean of consciousness, which has no beginning, no end. It's infinite to an extent that we can't even conceive. Vishnu lies on the ocean, supported by the great serpent Ananta. Ananta's name means endless. And the serpent represents the Kundalini power within the vital essence within Vishnu. Which is the support of all the worlds. And in many of the representations, and you'll see this in the one on the website, he's accompanied by his consort Lakshmi, who sits at his feet. She massages his feet. She's a very, very faithful, loving consort. Vishnu lies in the Milky Ocean, and as he sleeps, he dreams. His dream is the world. And as Vishnu sleeps on the Milky Ocean in the state called Yoga Nidra, he imagines, he dreams, the endless universes, universes that we can't even imagine. This universe that we live in is just one, according to the texts of this tradition, is just one of countless universes. And it's said in each one of these universes, there is a Vishnu asleep on the cosmic ocean, dreaming the universe in his mind. So when we practice meditation, when we practice visual meditation, what we're really doing is replicating Vishnu's dream of the worlds. So the story goes that there's a sage known as Markandeya. Markandeya has been given the boon of being immortal. And in this particular moment in cosmic history, the sage Markandeya is wandering inside Vishnu. He's literally inside the body of the god, wandering over the peaceful earth. He's a wandering sadhu. And he looks at the world with great love. He's thousands of years old, but he's completely alert. He has a brilliant mind. And as he wanders through the interior of Vishnu's great body, he's visiting holy places. He's looking at the lives of the sages and their students. This is in very ancient times in India, when there were still a lot of sages and students and shrines and holy places. And he's just delighted to see the love that's manifesting in all these worlds. But suddenly, he's wandering through a perfectly ordinary field, and suddenly he inadvertently falls out through the mouth of Vishnu. You know, Vishnu's sleeping, his mouth's a little bit open. He's breathing. It's the cosmic night. The world is inside his body. And when Markandeya falls from Vishnu's lips, he's cast into the cosmic sea. And he's floating on the cosmic sea. He doesn't realize that there's this vast god sleeping on it. All he sees is the ocean, which is dark and endless, and there are no boats, there's nothing there, and he's filled with despair and fear. He's splashing around in the water. And then he begins to wonder, is this a dream? Is this some kind of magic? I mean, this weird occurrence must be happening in my imagination, because it can't be that the world could have just dissolved, that this beautiful world could have just dissolved into nothingness. I mean, there's no sun, there's no moon, there's no earth, there's no mountains. What? Where am I finding myself? What is this? And as Markandeya contemplates this, this is the nature of the masculine consciousness, by the way, is to ask these questions. What's real? You know, he's actually contemplating the nature of this universe. Is there such a thing as a manifest world? Or is it all a dream? Is it all a delusion? And what he recognizes is that while he was wandering around inside Vishnu, inside this world that Vishnu is dreaming, he'd actually seen a universe, seen a world that was the product of his own mind, his own being. He was a saintly, beautiful person, and the world that he projected was a beautiful world. And yet, and he'd of course seen it as real and substantial, but in fact, what he was seeing was a dream inside the body of Vishnu. Just think about this. This is the fundamental paradox, the wild recognition that the Eastern traditions offer us. This world, which is so solid, so real, it's a dream. And as Markandeya is splashing around in the cosmic ocean, completely depressed, you know how it is when you have this recognition that what you've thought of as a solid world is actually empty of substance. This happens sometimes in meditation, and it can be very scary. And suddenly he becomes aware of the form of Vishnu, the sleeping god. And as he sees it, he becomes ecstatic. The shape of Vishnu looks like a mountain range breaking out of the waters. It glows. It's so beautiful. It's filled with light. And Markandeya swims nearer, and he's just opened his mouth to ask what it is when suddenly Vishnu seizes him, swallows him, and Markandeya is once again inside the familiar landscape of this earth, this universe, this beautiful, green, divine, ancient, sacred India. But at this moment, Markandeya has been given a glimpse of the emptiness, and he's completely confused. And he thinks, well, this experience of emptiness must have been some kind of vision. And yet, he, the human being who can't understand and accept that there's anything outside his own mind, is now inside the divine being. He's a figure in Vishnu's dream, and yet he has become a sage who has seen through the illusion, who's seen the endless sea of consciousness within which this dream takes place. So he goes back to his life, and he wanders for several hundred years, having this beautiful life, and then once again, he slips out of Vishnu's mouth and finds himself in the dark sea. But this time, inside this silent, watery expanse, he sees a luminous child, a beautiful boy sitting beneath a fig tree on an island floating in the sea, peaceful, in slumber, cheerful, completely undismayed, despite the fact that he's floating in the middle of this shoreless night ocean. And Markandeya is fully curious, but he can't really bear the light of the child, so he stays at a slight distance, keeping himself afloat, and he remembers that somehow long ago he had this recognition, but when he remembers that emptiness, he's filled with fear. But here now, Vishnu, who's now appearing as a divine child, says to him, "Welcome, Markandeya. Don't be afraid. Don't fear. Come to me." And he now, Markandeya comes a little bit closer, and the boy says to him, "Child, I am your parent. I'm your father. I'm the primeval being who gives you life. Why don't you come to me? I knew your father, who practiced profound austerities in order to have you for a son. Your father knew the core of his existence. He knew the essence from which he came, and you come from that. That's your heritage. That's who you are. That's why you can see me lying on the primal waters, playing as a child beneath the tree." And Markandeya says to him, "O Vishnu, let me know the secret of your Maya. How is it that you can appear as a child playing in the sea? What name should I call you?" And Vishnu says, "I am the cosmic man, Narayana, the sacred masculine. I'm the source of the universe. I have 1,000 heads. I'm the sacred fire. I'm the lord of the waters. I'm the divine yogi, the cosmic juggler, the magician who creates wonderful illusions. My magical deceptions are the infinite changes of this world, this display of the mirage of the process of the universe is the work of my Shakti, but I'm also the whirlpool which sucks it back into itself. I put an end to everything that exists, and then I bring it forth again." And then he goes on to say, "I am Dharma, I am yoga, I am every beautiful thing that manifests in this world. I am the Lord, the Creator, the Wise One. I am celestial light. I am the supreme refuge." Just let yourself listen to this, because this is the litany of the sacred masculine. "I am the primeval being and the supreme refuge. From me originates whatever has been, whatever will be. And whatever you see, hear, or know in this whole universe, know that it is me. I am beyond the goals of human life. And yet I point out these goals and show you how to live." And at this moment, the primordial being brings Markandeya back to his mouth and swallows him, so that he vanishes again into the world inside Vishnu. But this time, he's filled with love and joy. And so he sits under a tree, and his attention moves into the very center of his being, and he begins to sing the divine song, Soham Hamsa. One of the meanings of Hamsa is swan, divine swan. And the image of the divine swan is one of the core images of the yogi in Indian tradition. In fact, a self-realized yogi, a attained yogi, is called a Paramahamsa, a supreme swan. The swan swims on the surface of the water, but he's not bound to it. He can fly. And Markandeya, with this recognition, saw that he was completely immersed in the life of the world, and yet he was free to recognize the primordial vastness of the Absolute. And as he sat with his awareness indrawn, as I'd like you to do now, and allowed the breath to flow up and down the central core of the body, flowing in and down towards the base and up towards the crown, he realized that his breath was saying, Hamso, I am he, I am that. I am that supreme being, the divine one, the cosmic, primordial Purusha, whose body contains the world, who is the source and the ground of all that is. So as the breath flows in with hum, in and down through the center, towards the base, and up through the center, towards the crown with so, let yourself merge into the dance of the breath. Recognize that bound to this body, limited in strength, having some good qualities and some bad ones, having a consciousness that only occasionally expands, still, you are the microcosmic form of that divine essence, which is unlimited, which is immortal, which is filled with wisdom, beauty, and freedom. So you live in these two worlds, bound by the body, utterly free as spirit. You are that. You are he. So hum. Hum with the inhalation, so with the exhalation, allowing the breath to remind you moment by moment of who you are. You are the supreme consciousness who plays as the universe and you are that principle, the self, inside your personhood. You are Bhagwan, the Lord. And you are the self, divine awareness taking form as your conscious mind. And your consort, your divine feminine, manifests as the body, as thoughts and emotions, as the physical world around you. And the two of you, divine masculine and divine feminine, live as you. Just let yourself be present with that mystery as the breath flows in with hum and out with so. And you let yourself float in that awareness. You'll be receiving homework and an audio meditation, contemplation questions. And if you have a partner or would like a partner, you can write to Deb and she'll make sure you have one. It's important in the course of this class that you actually practice the contemplations and the daily meditation, because there's a psycho-alchemical process that goes on in these teleconferences that manifests through the classes as tonight, but also through the practice that you do during the week. And please feel free to share your experience and your questions through the listserv. I'll answer questions, and if there's something that feels personal and you want to send it to me, Sally@sallykempton.com, that's okay. I'll answer those personal questions. But as many of you know, when you ask your questions on the listserv, it often inspires tremendous wisdom, insight, helps answer the questions of others, and allows us to communicate, because part of the power of these satsangs is the community experience of sharing and receiving that occurs on the listserv. So have a beautiful evening, a beautiful week. Stay in touch. Many blessings. Namaste. Soham. Be well.